This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, hi, hello, welcome into this week's episode of the show.
I'm not actually getting quieter. I just wanted to see if you would be weirded out by that, Sam.
I mean, I am. I'm listening to you on not full blast, but like I wanted to turn up my podcast device.
Yeah. Just to be like, whoa, what is going on with this dude? I'm just back from a few days in the mountains. My brain feels so cleared out. I'm also talking right now consistently because my phone is ringing in the other room and I forgot to turn the ringer off. And so I'm just trying to talk over it while it rings. But so my brain is cleared out. Figured I'd just start this episode by trying to confuse you. You know, it's a very mature podcast that we do here.
Yeah. When we talk about the Rocky Mountain vibes, not just the baseball team.
Right.
But apparently it's what you are exhibiting and bringing the energy that you are bringing to the show
here. So refreshed, man. You know, my childhood best friend and I went camping for a few days and it was great. So here we are to welcome you into this week's episode, the 313th of the Show Before the Show podcast. My name is Tyler Mon. His name is Sam Dykstra, and we are set to talk a lot of baseball today. We've got some three strikes topics coming up here momentarily. We've got a great conversation here just after the jump. Benjamin Hill and I got to record an interview with members, quite literally, of the Redding Fightin' Phils family. We'll explain that coming up here in a little bit. Father's Day, of course, this weekend, and happy Father's Day to all of you fathers out there and to all of your fathers for this coming Sunday's celebration. So we got that coming up as well. And I was only gone for like 3 days. I feel like I've been out of the loop for a million years. How are you, Sam?
I'm good. Good. It's funny. You went into the mountains and like into nature and experienced the great outdoors. I went back to the office yesterday.
Yeah. How was it? I saw a post. Weird, normal-ish?
Normal-ish. Yeah. Okay. Normal-ish. I mean, I'm sure many of you at home are going through the same thing we are right now about the, how often should I go back to the office? What is that going to be like? Going into the MLB offices, there were a couple people that I work with who I've only gotten to know over Slack, really, over the last year. Got to meet them in person. That was great. Wore my mask pretty much everywhere around the office. Have to wear it at my desk being fully vaccinated. It was a small step towards normalcy.
Okay.
I will say. And because of the way the MLB office has been not upgraded, but it's been decorated since the last time we were there. It's kind of funny walking into that building and there's these giant posters of Aaron Judge and Mike Trout and Ronald Acuna Jr. And it feels like they're welcoming me to work every day.
That's cool.
Very cool feeling.
Yeah, we should explain to people MLB.com, MLB Network, MLB, the commissioner's office. Everybody for years was in all different locations. And our offices, the MILB.com offices, were down in Chelsea Market in New York City. And the commissioner's office was on Park Avenue. And the network was in Secaucus, New Jersey. And obviously studios and stuff are still there. But everybody, for the most part now, is under one roof. That happened in January, right?
Yes.
Of 2020. Yeah. So you guys got like a month at work in this new building and then the world shut down for what has felt like absolutely forever. And it's basically been 16 months now, 14, 15, 16 months. So it's like you kind of move into a new place and then just never see that place. So it's like, I would imagine it felt almost like an initiation day for the second time around.
Yeah. Not only that, but I moved my desk.
Oh, okay.
So it's like a completely new thing showing up in all the stuff that I had packed up a couple of weeks ago, knowing I was moving my desk, but like, it was literally just like, oh, here's a new spot in this new building that I still don't really know that well.
Crazy.
But there are some cool things about it. We don't have to get too much into the weeds of what our workplace is like, but
I haven't even been there. I've never been there.
I know, we needed to get you there.
I'm very excited.
If only to see some of the meeting rooms, which are named after baseball legends. Like there's a cool Papa Bell room and I think there's a Cal Ripken room and a Joe DiMaggio. Like, I look into Joe DiMaggio room now.
Very cool.
Pretty neat. I have not yet gone through and tried to book meetings in specific rooms just to say, like, hello from Ted Williams.
Right.
But I might do that going
soon.
Yeah.
We will do the podcast in some sweet room like that. Well, you'll do the podcast in some sweet room. I'll do the podcast in the same room that I always do it in.
We can name your room the Vinny Castilla room.
Yeah, that's true. We can do some cool. I mean, Larry Walker's a Hall of Famer now, so I feel like they should probably just name a room after him in that building. Maybe, or I could just find like the most random Rockies player in history. This is the Jason Bates room now. What's this is going to be? This is the Jeff Parrott room. You know, the legends of my lifetime.
Okay.
This is the Jorvit Torrealba room.
Okay. Now we're getting closer. Cause I feel like we were just
you were like three when the Rockies made their debut. Sam, we get it. You're young.
You were a Rockies hipster. It's fine. You saw games at Mile High Stadium.
I did. I was there at that first game. Eric Young's homer. You know, not to brag about cheering for one of the worst franchises in sports. Here we are in this week's episode of the show before the show, as we've thoroughly confused and baffled you all, but we're getting set to talk some real baseball things. And let's dive in for three strikes on this week's episode of the show before the show. We're going to kick it off with a lot of prospects moving up and getting shots at the next level. Guys headed to the big leagues, obviously, over the last few weeks, there have been prospect debuts and guys we've seen, you know, kind of going in both directions. We saw Jared Kelnick go to the big leagues, struggle there. He's back in AAA now, but continues to surge with the Tacoma Rainiers. And we are seeing other guys make the climb up the ladder in their various systems. And among them have been some of the biggest names in all of minor league baseball, including a guy who is currently the number three prospect in the entire game of baseball. That is the corner infielder Spencer Torkelson in the Detroit Tigers organization, who goes up from high A to double A. He makes that move with the fourth ranked prospect in his system, Dylan Dingler, the catching prospect who the Tigers took in the second round last year out of Ohio State. But Hunter Green making a move up, Cade Cavalli, friend of the show, making a move up, Shane Boz making a move up. Right now, what has been the lesson that you've learned from some of these promotions and what we've seen from these guys so far?
Yeah, I mean, this was, for all intents and purposes, prospect moving week. That's how I kind of thought of it, which is interesting because I feel like mid-June is normally when that actually happens in a regular season.
Yeah.
When we're starting first week of April, because around now is when minor league all-star games would happen. Guys would get, you know, their honors there. They would get to go and participate in that. And then you would ship them off to the next level because obviously they had a good first half. So teams are kind of sticking to that schedule now. And I think part of that is, and I've said this plenty of times on this show and elsewhere, but still, a lot of teams were trying to figure out where to send guys to begin 2021. The lost year last year, you know, kind of put everybody in the wild west of player assignment. And everybody was trying to figure out, okay, do we bump this guy up two levels? Do we bump this guy up three levels? Do we hold him back and act like, you know, 2020 never happened and only move him up a half measure? We saw something like that with like Grayson Rodriguez, who went from low A to high A. And then the Orioles quickly realized, okay, wait, he should really be at double A. Or Francisco Alvarez a couple weeks ago, who had never seen full season ball. So the Mets wanted to get him in full season ball, quickly realized he wasn't being challenged at low A St. Lucie and moved him up to high A Brooklyn. This group is kind of, you know, we knew that they were going to need to prove themselves a little bit longer. Spencer Torkelson and Cade Cavalli were first round picks last year. So they didn't have any pro ball experience. So starting them out at high A, like you normally do with a college player, didn't feel that conservative or aggressive, really. It felt about right, but both guys absolutely dominated both of those levels. Torkelson took a little bit of time to warm up to high A, but I think part of that was he took some time off for a hamstring injury. Seems like a completely different hitter coming back, and finished up with a 312, 440, 569 slash line. So that was an OPS above 1,000. He had five homers in 31 games. Moving now to Erie, I think he's going to hit even more homers. Erie is actually normally a home run friendly ballpark, so we could see that slugging number take off the more he plays in Erie. But Cade Cavalli had a 1.77 ERA. He actually leads all minor league baseball now with 71 strikeouts and only 40 and two thirds innings. Crazy numbers for him. He struck out 15 batters in seven no hit innings last time out on June 12th. And if there was ever a start to be like, hey guys, I really have nothing left to prove here, it's that. It's 15 strikeouts and 7 no-hit innings. He actually had double-digit strikeouts in 4 of his last 5 outings at Wilmington. So him moving up to Harrisburg made a lot of sense. Hunter Green, I think we've said this. We featured him in MILB TV games of the week saying, like, go watch Hunter Green because he's going to hit 100 consistently. He's going to get it up to 102 even. His slider has been really, really good, and his changeup seems to be improving. That's how you end up with 60 strikeouts and 41 innings for him and a 1.98 ERA and 7 starts. But he was somebody who missed all of 2019 due to Tommy John surgery and then was pitching as part of, like, alt-site play and some instructs with the Reds last year. But the last time he pitched, he was at low A Dayton, and trying to come back from that Tommy John surgery. We just didn't know what kind of pitcher he was going to be like. Put him at double A. Even that felt maybe a tad aggressive, but still showed that he's very much the pitcher he was before surgery. His results are even better on the field. He's matured in the way he pitches to batters. So get him that next challenge at triple A Louisville. And we'll see what happens to the Reds. I've heard people mention, could Green sneak into a bullpen spot by the end of the year? We'll see. We'll see what his pitch count's going to be at, what his innings limit is. But we obviously know that the velocity is going to play for him. And Shane Hawes has some of the best stuff in the majors, or in the minors rather. His fastball really moves. I remember when he moved from the Pirates to the Rays, he said the Rays really liked the movement on that fastball. And they said, hey, just throw this. Like, it moves a ton. And it moves in ways we really like. So just lean on this pitch. And it seems to have worked really well. He does have some complimentary pitches as well. But what's really taken off for him this year, starting out at Double A Montgomery, and which led to the promotion to Triple A Durham, and he made his debut this week, was the fact that he struck out 49 batters. He walked only 2. So if he has this stuff that thrives on its movement and he's finding the strike zone this much, that's incredible. I mean, he could easily jump into the top 50 overall prospects, maybe even higher than that, if this command and control stuff sticks. But that's as if the Rays needed another exciting piece at Triple A Durham. They certainly add him right now. He actually turns 22 years old today, so he's very young for the Triple A level. But what no better, there is no better birthday present than jumping one step away from the major league. So we'll keep an eye on all these guys. Challenges are going to come. That's why they got moved up. Just letting them mash or strike everybody out at the levels they were at isn't going to help their development, but that's what we're going to see here in the next days and weeks. And maybe they'll even pass that test and move up again. I think Torkelson especially could see a third level given what he did at Arizona State and what he was showing there at the end at West Michigan. But all 4 of these guys are becoming must follows very quickly.
Strike 2 is very related to this conversation. Who is next in this line, Sam? Whether it's somebody getting promoted in the minors, maybe somebody who's going to make a big league debut. Right now, who kind of seems like they've moved up on the docket to maybe be on deck, baseball term, when it comes to promotions?
Yeah, so I'll keep this to within the minor leagues because, again, this like moving week seems to be based on getting guys new challenges. For the major leagues, you're calling somebody up to fill a need, and we're seeing that with Matt Manning, right? Matt Manning, as we're recording this on Thursday, is making his major league debut tonight. It was not at a point in which the Tigers probably would have liked to have done that. He actually leads AAA in ERA right now with the highest ERA at that level. But injuries to Spencer Turnbull and Matthew Boyd led to the Tigers needing arms. Matt Manning is a good arm to have. He's going to make his major league debut. So there's lots of other calculus that goes into MLB debuts. But in terms of call-ups within the minors, a couple names I want to throw out here real quick. Adley Rutschman, you know, if we're getting to the point where Spencer Torkelson's moving up, Adley Rutschman is at his highest level ever at Double A Bowie. But given conversations I've had with people with the Orioles, given what he's been able to show at the plate so far, kind of the timeline we expected him to be on, I don't think he's going to be in Bowie for long. I think there is something to be said for him working with Grayson Rodriguez for a while and working with that staff at Bowie, which is obviously very talented. But in terms of what he's showing hitting wise, like, he's going to need a challenge before long. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him in Norfolk at the AAA level by 4th of July. I would say Julio Rodriguez, friend of the podcast, Tyler, you got to see just how electric he was at Olympic qualifiers at High A Everett right now. It seems like every night he's doing something. He's continuing to hit the ball. I thought him moving up to High or not even moving up, that's a level he finished 2019 at, was pretty passive. He's passing all the tests so far over there in Everett. I think he can certainly move up in the next couple of weeks. One name I want to throw out here that I didn't, or that I had in my initial MLB.com piece that is not going to result in a promotion anytime soon is DL Hall. The Orioles have actually announced that he's going to be shut down for a little while with an injury, I believe to the shoulder. He got off to a really strong start. Control was a little iffy, but he was striking out at least 40% of the batters he faced at AA. Really promising start getting him together with Rodriguez and Rutschman made that Bowie team very exciting to watch. And I thought Rutschman and Hall might not last very long given what they had already shown in 2021, but sounds like it's going to be a while for them. One other name I want to throw out real quick, because I did say the Mariners have been passive with Rodriguez this year, but they have been aggressive with younger prospects in the past, thinking back to Jared Kelnick in 2019 when they sent him up three levels. Noelvi Marte in that Mariners system, currently at low A Modesto, but just tearing the cover off the ball there. And yes, it is the old California League that Modesto plays in. But he's comfortably had, OPSs around 1,000 pretty much for the year. At the time I wrote this, his 999 OPS was second among all minor leaguers who are 19 or younger, only behind Francisco Alvarez, who had moved up. He's gotten better in June than he was in May. We kind of had him circled as somebody who could have some helium, but he hadn't played above the Dominican Summer League, I believe, coming into this year. So the fact that the Mariners sent him to Modesto, they wanted him to find his feet, but he's certainly doing that. And I think at a certain point, you're going to want to see him, what happens when you're pitching up, going up against a little bit tougher pitching. I think he'll find that at high A. And I think that will probably happen before mid-July, but that's just my guess right now. But the way Marte is performing, he's not only going to climb up the Seattle ranks, he's going to climb up prospect rankings as well.
And strike three this week, we are, ordinarily we'd be at this stage talking about we're near the midway point of a minor league baseball season. Obviously, we're essentially a month and a half into this season, and we're past the stage of, well, small sample size, this guy is doing X, Y, or Z. So right now, looking across leaderboards in minor league baseball, there are stat leaders who stand out in a lot of categories. Joe Adell right now, the minor league home run leader, he's kind of shared that honor with a handful of players across the minors at times. Cade Cavalli, we were talking about just a little bit ago, strikeout leader in the minor leagues. Who right now among leaders, current minor league stat leaders, Sam, is likely to end the year in that position in their categories?
Yeah, I guess the obvious answer for me right now is Cade Cavalli. I mean, we mentioned, again, that strikeout total right now, stands at 71 through 40 and two thirds innings. He's going to be challenged here at Double A Harrisburg, but by the look and sound of it, he's got the velocity to handle Double A for sure. He's got the full range of pitches, I think, to make that jump work. It's been really fun to see him take off in this way, because we were like, he's a first round pick, so everybody knows him, but a lot of that is based off what he was showing in his junior year, but that got cut short, which we talked to him about a little bit. The fastball is good. The slider is above average. The changeup is above average. What's going to happen when he has to go up against pro batters? And the fact that he made high A batters look silly is really enticing to me. I think the biggest thing that could hold him back from that potentially is, again, coming off the 2020 season, not many innings in that arm between Oklahoma and then whatever he got last year during his brief time in the Nats system. What is his innings limit going to look like? Are they going to cut him off at like 110 or 120? And that could hurt his ability to lead in strikeouts. But that's basically true of everyone, I guess. Like nobody really pitched a lot last year, except for, in their backyards and in some facilities here and there. So I think if anybody, he's certainly like, other than Joe Adell, but Joe Adell's at AAA already. Like, I think he's going to get called up to the Angels at some point. And I don't think he's going to lead the minors in home runs, but he's like the most notorious minor league leader right now that I think that he could actually hold on to that. I mean, I do love, that Ken Waldichuk still has a 0.00 ERA over 32 thirds innings. And it sounds like that's real. That's not like, he's been more dominant than we were expecting in the Yankee system. He too is moving up to Double A Somerset, but I'm not going to reject that anybody other than Jacob DeGrom is going to have his ERA below one. So We'll keep an eye on this stuff for sure. It's fun to check in at the 6 week level. Tyler, was there anybody you had on your list?
You know, I do very much love some of the names that pop out of, I don't want to say nowhere essentially, but names you haven't necessarily thought about a whole lot before. You know, Waldichuk is a guy who I don't think the average fan probably really knows a ton about. There's a pitcher also in the Yankee system right now in Glenn Otto, who has been putting up absurd strikeout numbers as of this season. I know I wrote up a blurb for one of his stories just the other day on, you know, another 9 strikeout, I think 0 walk game for him. So there are these guys who on minor league leaderboards you may not be super aware of as of yet, but that's kind of where a lot of guys put themselves into the forefront of prospect observers' minds. Is there's so many guys in minor league baseball, guys are going to fall through the cracks at times. And when you see performers take that next step and put up, you know, absurd numbers, whether it's at a certain level and you think, okay, maybe this is just sort of a helium performance, a guy who's going to get promoted. And then all of a sudden we'll see what he's really made of. You know, somebody like Glenn Otto is doing this right now in AA with the Somerset Patriots. And so far this season, which is his fourth in pro ball, 3.95 ERA, which, you know, maybe a little on the high side for a guy who's had these numbers, but he struck out 69 batters and walked 11 in 41 innings so far this season. So that's an arm that, you know, I've kind of come across over the last few weeks. And Ken Waldichuk, weirdly enough, is one spot ahead of him in the organizational rankings and is on that same Somerset roster right now. And in that rotation, 27th ranked prospect Waldichuk, the 28th ranked prospect is Otto. I love those guys who just, you don't really talk about. They're in the back end of organizational rankings, but all of a sudden they come on, you think, okay, maybe there's something here that, you know, in the Yankee system, we're so mindful of Jason Dominguez and Davey Garcia and, you know, Clark Schmidt and Oswald Peraza and all of those guys. Maybe there are other guys in this system who we need to be keeping an eye on as well. Those are some of my favorite stories across minor league baseball year after year.
Yeah. Yeah. And one other one I'll throw out real quick is Joe Gray Jr.
Yeah.
The Milwaukee Brewers. He leads minor league baseball right now in RBIs with 42 through 36 games at low A. Somebody who had been circled as like, this guy has a decent amount of tools. He has the raw power. He has above average speed. He has a good arm. Is he ever going to hit enough? You know, we'll have to see. Starting out this year at low A in his age 21 season. So he is a little old for that level to be a legit prospect, but hitting above 300, he's got an OBP over 400. He's flirting with a 700 slugging percentage. He's taking all the boxes to put himself back on the map. And I know he's on the outside looking in right now of the Brewers list for MLB Pipeline, but between graduations, trades, all that kind of stuff, and his own performance, he's the exact type of guy who, through performance alone, could force his way back into it.
And that's 3 strikes for this week's episode of the show before the show. Coming up, we are headed to the Reading Fight and Phils organization where we get a chance for a family interview. Father's Day is coming up and we've got the patriarch of one of baseball's best minor league baseball families, Tom Hunziker, who is a member of the Fightins roster, essentially in a strange way. He is a mascot who is 70 years old now. Tom Hunziker will join the show and he will be joined with us, with me and Benjamin Hill, by his son, Reading Fight and Phils general manager Scott Hunziker, and Scott's brother Todd, who is the chief director of promotions for the Reading Fight and Phils. It's Father's Day week, and we're talking with the baseball family coming up next.
Here on the Show Before the Show podcast, Tyler Maughan and I are joined by 3 Hunziker men. Scott Hunziker, the general manager of the Reading Fight and Phils, his brother, Todd, the chief director of promotions, and their father, Tom, who I'm not sure if he has an official title, but he has perhaps the most impressive title as what we believe is the oldest mascot in minor league baseball. Tom just turned 70 years old. And so it's a very unique relationship here in Reading, Pennsylvania. Brothers on the same front office staff, father is a mascot. This segment will be running the week of Father's Day, and you know, we just wanted to tie it all together and talk about a unique father-son's relationship in minor league baseball. So first of all, guys, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here. Nice.
Yeah. So where to begin? We'll start, Scott, you've been with the team the longest, almost 30 years now. From that point, how did you get the rest of your family in on the operation?
That's a great question. Well, it certainly wasn't part of the plan necessarily, but we have a really close family. and do everything together. My dad was our coach growing up. So sports, you know, we always sort of did it together. So when I started working here in 92, my father, my brother, my whole family would always come to the games, and they weren't that local. They're from Philadelphia and we're in Reading, Pennsylvania. So it was like an hour drive. But that just continued over time. And eventually we decided to add additional mascots. And, you know, we have like 5-6 mascots. And as anyone who has mascots knows, the hardest thing about a mascot is the human inside the mascot. It's like a great concept to be like Disney World and have, you know, hundreds of mascots, but then you need a lot of humans. And it takes a special kind of person. So I was telling my father that story, and he's like, I've always wanted to be a mascot, you know, and he was always so great with the kids as a youth coach and everything. So I wasn't too sure if he was serious or not, but long story short, he started mascotting and became a part of our organization as a mascot. And then shortly thereafter, my brother started an internship with us after his career in teaching. And he became the duck in the mascot band, and they're in the mascot band. I don't know how to play any musical instruments, so I'm just kind of like the sound guy. But that's kind of how we all ended up here together. And it's a family environment, as everyone listening to this knows. Minor league baseball is a family environment, and our organization is built around family atmosphere in the front office. So there's no better way to have a family atmosphere than to actually have real family. And I'm lucky. I get to go to work with my brother every day. I get to work with my dad as a mascot, you know, 2-3 times a homestand. So it's awesome. I'm a blessed person.
Yeah, it is awesome story. And you mentioned the mascot band, and we'll get to that in a moment. But to start, Tom, you just turned 70 years old recently, and I'm not sure if we keep records of these sort of things, but as far as anyone knows, you're the oldest mascot in minor league baseball, doing it for I think over 20 years now. You know, how do you stay in shape and keep doing this? I mean, I'm quite a bit younger than you are, and I don't think I would have the stamina to be in a mascot suit, and you're doing it at age 70. It's a story of inspiration. So how do you stay in condition to do such grueling work while dressed as Change Up the Turtle?
Well, it's just staying active all the time, playing golf, coaching little league baseball, going to the gym. And when you love to do something, it really becomes quite easy to do it. Short answers.
Yeah. And his years of training, and he was a Stroman's bread truck driver. They don't have any air conditioning in those trucks. Oh, yeah. So he would spend all day in the truck in the heat. So he was telling me the other day, being in the mascot costume is a lot easier than that.
Yeah. You get used to it. You get used to it.
Todd, for you being on the promo side, you guys always, you know, between a promo director and a general manager, there's so much collaboration and coordination and all of that. But the fact that you've got a brother who's in that position, your dad is one of your mascots. How much do you feel like you kind of, I would imagine you can throw anything out in any context, and there's a conversation with, you know, people that you're so close with about how can we make this better? I mean, what's it like getting to work with guys that you've known your entire life to make the, you know, one of the real crown jewel franchises in minor league baseball better year after year on the promotion side?
Yeah, it's been awesome. And it's really just been a continuation of what we've always done since we were kids, really. I know we always tell the story that we had a nice backyard with a cool little wiffle ball field, and we used to, you know, not just play wiffle ball. We used to plan some wiffle ball tournaments, and Scott was always kind of taking the lead on that, organizing everything. But, you know, I always kind of backed him up with trying to add some music and, you know, brackets for the tournaments and things like that. So really, it's not much of a different concept. And we kind of function and work together the same way as when we were in the backyard playing some Little League games, just for a lot more people. And a lot more fun, really, to bring everybody involved.
One of the neatest identities in minor league baseball, I mean, you guys with the baseball town energy, the image, the feel of the ballpark, the you know, community aspect of what the Fightin' Phils are in Reading. How do you guys feel like the community is reflected in your family and vice versa. I mean, when you see families at the ballpark, I would imagine there are a lot of people who are aware of the relationship between you three and, you know, growing up in the area and Philly's ties and all of that. What does that mean to have this relationship in your front office, but also as a wider part of a community that's so tightly knit for a minor league baseball franchise?
You want to take that one first?
I guess I should have addressed that to somebody.
I guess I would say that, you know, when I went to college, I thought I was going to be a guidance counselor and a coach. And that's, you know, when my mom and dad sent me to school, that's what I trained to be. And then I did this internship sort of randomly my senior year during baseball season. And the thing I fell in love with was families coming to the ballpark that didn't know each other and talk, and they would talk to each other. And it fascinated me. My dad's a real outgoing guy as a coach, as a youth coach. We always, you know, knew all the families that played in our organization, also the other team. We always met the other team, talked to the other team. And honestly, I was like struck when I started working here, but not by the baseball so much. I love it. But like the families talking to each other, complete strangers, which is really weird now in 2021 coming out of a pandemic, because we almost have to like retrain our brains to do that, you know, that we can talk to a strange family that's sitting at the seats next to us. But honestly, I think that to answer your question, you know, that's what drew me to this. That's what made me decide to take this job instead of other opportunities. And so for us to be here working together is really just a continuation of that. You know, and Ben's covered this before, but we have a concession stand where we have a grandmother, a mother, and grandchildren all working in the same concession stand. And so we're not unique here. This is a fascinating three-generational place. You know, my kids work here a little bit now when they can. And so we're three generations, but we have that amongst our other game staff employees. And our front office, most of our front office's spouse and significant others work here, which is common around our industry. Look, we're here all the time. And I think my dad will tell you, you know, one of the reasons that he sort of took the mascot job was, you know, when your kid's 25 years old working in minor league baseball, you don't see him much. And one of the reasons he took the mascot job was a couple, three times a week, we'd get to hang out. So that's kind of, you know, a long-winded answer, but there really is no line of demarcation between what we're doing and what our fans are doing when they come to the game. I mean, they're spending time with their family and we're spending time with our family. So it's sort of a natural progression.
Well, I said I'd get back to this because it's a topic that really needs to be explored. But the mascot band, one of those quintessential minor league baseball oddities, a full band of mascots banging out, you know, garage rock classics, rocking in the free world, that sort of thing. Todd and Tom are both members of the band, or at least, you know, their respective mascots are. And so tell me a little bit about the origin of this most unusual band and the kind of songs you like to play and what it's like having a father and son on stage rocking out as mascots.
You know more about the origin.
Let me tee it up and then you take it as the artist. So Chuck Domino had an idea. We had like a space in the stadium where we didn't know what to do, and he was trying to describe to me like Chuck E. Cheese, where you put like a quarter in and those like animated mechanical robotic things play music. I thought he meant like actual humans inside mascot costumes. He meant one of those mechanical things, which would have cost like $50,000, $100,000, those animatronic things, you know. So that misunderstanding led to, well, maybe we could have people play it. But I was like, dude, if you know musicians, like one of the reasons you're a musician is because like you want people to know it's you playing the music. So to like remove your identity was an oddity. The only chance at it was my brother was playing some guitar and singing. So I took the duck costume, I guess it was.
And different game up here. I was just hanging out, you know, came up as much as I could in the summers when I was teaching. And they kind of threw the idea at me. And I happened to have a guitar in my car, which I often did, it, you know, at that time in my life. Brought it inside. They put a mascot, just the head on me, and played a couple of chords. And everybody fell over laughing. And I think it was like 2 weeks later, we debuted the mascot band. So it all happened very quickly. And it's pretty crazy to think 20 years later,
We're still doing it, and we still have the original four members of the mascot band. And for one of those to be my dad, I mean, as I grew up, you know, playing violin and saxophone and early in school and everything, certainly never envisioned being in a rock and roll band with my father this many years later. But it's been awesome. And it's, yeah, the other members as well, you know, Bucky the Beaver's best friend, Mike Fink, is one of the original four members, and Screwball's best friend, Dean Stump, has been around for 20 years as well. We've had Blooper the Hound Dog has kind of rotated over the years, but we've had the same guy, Gene Sweeney, playing lead guitar as Blooper's best friend for probably 13 or 14 years now. So, yeah, it's been quite a fun, furry mascot ride.
I got to ask, are there like super fans of the mascot band? You guys get like the Play Wonderwall. Like, what are your big hits? What's the fan dynamic like?
There are. Well, it's funny, you know, if we've found a certain, we do mix in, you know, mix the songs up to a certain degree, but there's definitely some songs we've been playing for like 20 years. You know, when you find the humans that are willing to play in a mascot costume and we actually find some songs that work, you know, you don't mess with that.
You stick with them.
So
it's a working
generally
formula.
I think for 20 years we've opened almost every show with American Band by Grand Funk Railroad, and we've closed every show with Rockin' in a Free World, and in between we just have a whole bunch of fun. So, but yeah, there are super fans of all ages, honestly. You know, we used to be we started as a post-game concert band, you know, really hanging around for the adults who wanted to have a few more adult beverages after the game. And that set list was a little different than what we do now, because we did realize that little kids weren't seeing the mascot band. You know, the crowd after the game was more skewed toward adults. So about halfway into the mascot band years, they proposed the idea of switching it to a pregame concert. And that's really when it started to take off, and kids really started to identify with the band members, you know, and with rock and roll, which is kind of, you know, in today's modern music and everything, it's really nice to help promote good old fashioned rock and roll and playing some real instruments. So that's definitely always, you know, an undercurrent of the mascot band's message as well.
Rock and roll will never die. And Tom, you play the bongos in this band. Were you a you know, accomplished bongo player going into this, or was it learning?
No, they have five costumes. They needed somebody, so they they looked around, and I said, "I'll do it." And I started on a pair of electronic drums, little Yamaha electronic drums, and then for Christmas I got a set of congas, which it's a great Christmas present for, I think it was 55 or something at the time. I got my congas. Actual congas, but the other musicians are extremely, extremely talented musicians, and I am just a percussionist of sorts.
Well, he likes to sell himself short there, but I remember as a kid growing up, driving around in the car, he was one of the best steering wheel dashboard drummers I've ever known. So, you know, he likes to say he never played an instrument, but he's been really playing the bongos, if you will, our whole lives.
The only instrument I can play, so I feel very good. The dashboard steering wheel thing is like a recognized musical form. I'm happy about that.
You can do more. You can do that. You can do more.
You're an inspiration, Tom.
Get a set of congas.
So he always wanted to be in a rock and roll band, and so that sort of happened there. You know, and I don't think he ever wanted to be a mascot, but and he's good at it. You know, honestly, some people, I guess, that listening to this think, oh, okay, yeah, Scott and Todd's dad wanted to be a mascot, so they entertained, you know, they let him. that's not it at all. I mean, if you've ever seen him be a mascot, he's the best. I mean, he's right, you know, his energy, and nobody can tell there's a seven-year-old guy in the costume. He doesn't let one kid go unattended or noticed. He dances out there like he's 21 years old, and you know, it really is inspirational, honestly, as a 51-year-old to see him out there doing it. And the fans acknowledge that he's got that energy, so it's pretty cool. He still coaches Little League Baseball with me and all that stuff, so you know, hopefully I'll be able to sustain it like he has.
Yeah, well, Tom, when I interviewed you in Reading about being a mascot, you know, you said your goal was to work till you were 70 and beyond. And, you've hit that milestone and still going strong? Or you reassessing those goals or just taking it one day at a time and
just going to go. Just I quit when I collapsed.
Well, it's okay. That'll be a different kind of podcast.
I don't want to do that. I want to go on as long as I can. As long as I can still, as long as I don't look like a 70-year-old in a costume, I'm going to keep going. Once I start looking like that, we'll be time to think about being an usher.
Yeah, he's in probably the best shape he's been in a long time. And it's funny because as our season approaches, he like goes into like baseball player mode. Like he's got to get ready like for spring training. And it's hilarious. You know what I mean? So it's like, I got to get ready. Mascot's coming up. And he takes it pretty serious. You know, he's like, he won't ride in the golf cart. He's got to walk the course, you know, because he's got to get ready for being a mascot. And, you know, for people that aren't like around him very often that hear that, they're like, this guy's getting in shape to do what? What the heck is he talking about?
Better.
But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's kept us together, but it's also kept them, you know, physically fit and everything like that. That's a good message too for you know, our sons and all kids.
Yeah, well, it is a unique story and an inspiring story and quintessentially minor league baseball. So Scott and Todd and Tom, yeah, can't wait to see the mascot band play again. And it's only in minor league baseball, right? In advance, you know, happy Father's Day. And thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having us. Thank
you all very much.
Take care.
Interrupt this podcast to bring you another thrilling edition of Ghosts of the Miners. Now, here's your correspondent and host, Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to Ghosts of the Miners, in which all of you out there in Radioland must identify the legitimate historical ball club hiding amidst the fraudulent pair. One is the real deal, the others are phony baloney. In last week's segment, I asked you which of the following minor league baseball teams did at one time exist. A. The Woods Hole Deep Divers. B. The Miramar Beach Beachies. C. The Green Bay Bays. The correct answer is C. The Green Bay Bays. Now that we're at sea level, let's dive right in with the Bays, who surfaced late in the 19th century and got along swimmingly in the Wisconsin-Illinois League from 1909 through 1914. The Bays never floated to the top of the heap, but over those six seasons, they sometimes tied up the Freeport Pretzels, downed the Racine Malted Milks, and cut through the Wausau Lumberjacks. The Green Bay Bays came closest to getting their bottle in their first and last years, in each of which they finished second. In the prior, they were led by Felix Schwenard, who rose to the Chicago White Sox and sunk back to the Bays a couple times over the next few seasons, and manager John Pickett. Pickett's charge ultimately let him down, finishing 69-54 behind the consistently frustrating Madison Senators. In the latter, manager Bobby Lynch was the Bay's buoy, but not the linchpin needed for a title. Although Green Bay was a bit adrift between those two second-place finishes, the Bay stayed afloat with once or future big leaguers of lasting fame. We're talking about legends like Fritz Mollwitz and Joe Benz. After the 1914 campaign, the Bays and the rest of the Wisconsin-Illinois League could find no port in the storm that was the financial reality of pro baseball in the second decade of the 20th century. All the bookkeepers underwater, Green Bay would not harbor another minors team until 1940. We hope you've soaked up the facts on the Green Bay Bays, because that's about all the fun we can squeeze out of them. So now, let's test our gullibility with next week's question. Which of these unsuspecting teams of unsophisticated bumpkins gee-whizzed their way about the minors after the Second World War?
Hey, Ma, look at that pointy-haired little girl.
A. The East Moline Easy Marks. B. The Shreveport Suckers. C. The Riverside Rubes. Step right up, pay your nickel, and take a guess. Or just get the answer by tuning into next week's edition of Ghosts of the Miners. But for now, you'll have to excuse me. My producer Ben Hill is trying to make a peanut butter sandwich, and he's in an awful jam.
final segment of this week's episode of the show before the show. MILB.TV is your place to catch all of the top talent in minor league baseball as the summer rolls along. Sam, what are you watching on MILB TV this week?
Yeah, so this week I got my eye on Altoona is visiting Erie. So I mentioned up front, the Erie Seawolves now have Spencer Torkelson, who I expect to have even more power at the AA level because of the way the Erie Park plays, but also Dylan Dingler, Tyler, who you brought up, has also gotten that call from high A to double A. Dingler is a pretty exciting player. He's fairly athletic for somebody who's a catcher. Like, he's got an above average run tool. He can be a good hitter. He's been an even better hitter this year than I was expecting. I know the Tigers were very excited to add him to their system and were very excited based on what they had seen coming into this year. And he's certainly checked all the boxes. So don't just keep your eye on your Riley Green, your Spencer Torkelson, but also Dylan Dingler, I think, can be an exciting player. But you're going to want to watch all those three guys in the lineup regardless. But since they're playing the Altoona Curve also have O'Neill Cruz, who is somebody who I had circled as somebody who could get the call up to AAA pretty soon. He's somebody who already had AA experience coming into the year. He has added to that. He's got plus power. He had a highlight the other night in which his left fielder misplayed a ball. So he actually threw out a runner from short left field who was trying to get home. His arm really is a cannon. I tweeted out at the time, and I'll stand by this, the Pirates should just make him a right fielder at this point. He is way too tall to be shortstop.
Yeah.
Although all the reports there are pretty
six,
good.
6'7"?
6'7".
7?
6'7", yeah.
A lot.
Not hard to find him on the baseball field.
Yeah.
But his arm is really something special, and I think they would get more out of it putting it in right field than they would at short. But they really want to make that happen. So either way, you're going to see some sort of highlight out of O'Neill Cruz, I think, and having him on the same field as your, again, Riley Green, Spencer Torkelson, Dylan Dingler. That's a pretty good matchup and one you should all watch on MILB.TV. Tyler, what do you got your eye on?
Yeah, I'm going to go to a place near and dear to your heart and the Worcester Red Sox here in 2021 as Worcester getting this season underway for the first time at its new ballpark, Polar Park, which is Sam's Zoom backdrop, by the way, in a place that looks absolutely gorgeous as he shows it off here on the video. The Worcester Red Sox are rolling. They lost yesterday. We're recording this on Thursday the 17th. That snapped a 7-game winning streak in which they swept 6 straight from Syracuse and then beat Lehigh Valley in the opener of a 6-game series at home against the Iron Pigs. That team is a very interestingly comprised roster, and there's two guys that I've got an eye on right now, and this is obviously in a selfish manner because I just saw them recently at the Olympic qualifier for the international game. But Jeter Downs and Jarren Duran, who both played in that qualifier, Jeter Downs for his native Colombia, Jarren Duran is part of the U.S. team that qualified for the Olympics, so potentially a guy who could be in the Olympics coming up next month. Those two guys have kind of struggled since they returned from the qualifier, but I know this is a group that, you know, obviously the Red Sox are very excited about them with good reason. And those two guys, both pretty young, very dynamic talents. Jeter Downs is a really fun player to watch. He had 2 homers a few nights ago for the first time this season. He's only got 5 for the season, but he had 2 in a game on the 13th at Syracuse. He's a guy who, you know, has the potential to do something really fun, really exciting every night. And Jarren Duran is just a very consistent player. And I know was one who really, really impressed his teammates, his coaches with USA Baseball. Todd Frazier could not stop raving about Jarren Duran. And he's a guy who, you know, figures into that puzzle coming up in relatively short order, you would imagine, for the Red Sox. He's started the month a little bit slow, but have multi-hit games for 3 straight days from June 12th through the 15th, 3 straight games, I should say. So those two guys are in action this week against the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs. You can catch that game on MILB.TV. And that'll do it for this week's episode of the show before the show. You can get in touch with us, podcast at MILB.com. You can tweet at us at Sam Dykstra, MILB, and at Tyler Mon. And for Benjamin Hill, who is not here, big thanks to Ben for his help with the interview. And for Sam Dykstra, I'm Tyler. We'll talk to you next week.
It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro recharge kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.